Welcome into The Verge, a show which covers the Baltimore Orioles minor leagues. The Verge is part of BSL Radio. Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to analysis and discussion on the Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, and the University of Maryland. The site has a team of writers providing coverage of those teams and houses live streaming content weekly. Join the conversations at the message board, like BSL on Facebook, and follow BSL on Twitter.
And now a word from our new sponsor, Birdland Sports. Baseball season is finally here. And what better way to celebrate than with some fresh gear from Birdland Sports? As a small business run by Orioles fans, Birdland Sports offers a great selection of unofficial merchandise, including unique designs like Birds Are Coming tees, player cartoon shirts, and World Series prediction designs. And the best part? Their prices are more affordable than the big guys. Get high-quality gear without breaking the bank. So whether you're heading to the ballpark or watching from home, show your love for the Orioles with Birdland Sports. Visit birdlandsports.com today to browse their collection and gear up for the season. Let's go, O's. Welcome on The Verge. This is Zach Spedden, joined as always by Bob Phelan and Nick Stevens. We will get into the main topic of tonight's show in just one moment, but we want to start off by acknowledging some tragic news that hit the Orioles over the weekend with the death of minor league left-handed pitcher Luis Andres Ortiz Soriano at the young age of 20 years old. Ortiz died of leukemia, and the Orioles in a statement on Sunday said, quote, "We will miss his passion and love for the game of baseball, and we extend our deepest condolences to his family." Ortiz was originally signed by the Orioles out of the Dominican Republic in 2019 and pitched in the Florida Complex League in 2021. He did not appear in a game in 2022. On behalf of Bob and Nick, all of us here at On the Verge send our condolences to Ortiz's family and friends, as well as the Orioles organization, during this very trying time. We'll get in now to the main topic of tonight's show. We are joined by John Mioli, the author of Maximizing Playoff Odds, a Baltimore Orioles newsletter, which is available through Substack, and the contributor to Baseball America, who handles the Orioles' top 30 prospects, which you can currently read over at baseballamerica.com and in the Baseball America Top Prospect Handbook, which features Gunnar Henderson on the cover. So, John, you actually wrote about the cover player this year.
I know. I remember feeling a little weird that Adley wasn't on it last year, and I was like, I wonder if it'll be any different. Like, I wonder if it's going to be a different process if, like, the person's going on the cover. And it wasn't, but it just happened anyways. It was kind of cool to see.
Well, we're happy to see him on there after Bobby Witt Jr. got the cover last year. So let's start with this question. You've been doing this for Baseball America for several years now. Was there anything about this top 30 list that you thought was different from ones you've done previously?
There were a couple things. As I'm looking at it right now, you know, I put this together in like fall, so I always like doing this like in the spring, so I remember what it actually involved. I think as I'm looking through it now, like the overall top 30, even though there weren't any international prospects in the top 10, it's pretty clear that the Orioles' effort to sign players in the international market and devote resources to that is starting to come good. I know that, you know, everyone who follows that type of process along around the game knows that it takes time. It takes even more time considering that a lot of the players signed in 2019 and then pushed from July 2020 into January the next year were, you know, had a development meaningfully impacted by COVID and the lack of baseball. And it's a little bit of a catch-up game. But even with that, there's still, you know, there are players who are going to become much, much more known in the Orioles system just by virtue of getting this extra year of experience. And I think that's going to be an area where people are talking a lot about as the season goes on. Otherwise, I can't remember specifically if we talked about it on the top 10 one, but just like the caliber of players that were left out of the top 10 is kind of crazy. Like those are always the toughest decisions because people see the top 10 early and that's what they focus on. But with guys like Dylan Beavers and Heston Kerstad, you know, kind of at those next guys, you know, who were left out of the top 10, but easily could have been in it. You know, those are real players. Those are real prospects. And there were Orioles lists that only had a handful of those types of guys before. And now we're talking, it's like a dozen deep. So I think that's probably the headline takeaways.
Gunnar Henderson, who is struggling early in spring training. First of all, he's going to make the major league roster, right, at this point?
I would think so. I don't want to be the one that's going to say he's not.
We had a question about that in the patron group, so I wanted to get that out of the way. He'll graduate early in the season, and Grayson Rodriguez shouldn't be too far behind, which would leave Jackson Holliday as the number one prospect in the system. What do you think his outlook is for the season?
You know, honestly, I think we're looking at somebody who's going to be on the, you know, the 2021 Gunnar Henderson track. I haven't heard anything that makes me think he's not going to start in Delmarva, even though he got a little experience there last year. He's still really young. And I think they like that idea of getting, you know, that type of experience and getting his feet under him. And hopefully the same way, I'm sure they hope in the same way that Gunnar Henderson did, that Jackson Holliday like starts pretty well there. And then I'm interested to see like how he does in Aberdeen, given what we know about how left-handed hitters kind of struggle there, and just generally, you know, how it's come to be kind of accepted as an offense that, or a ballpark that depresses offense. You know, we have to remember that like basically a year on from like Gunnar Henderson being like the number one prospect in baseball, he was like not having a hit for 2 weeks and getting to Aberdeen like in his first full pro season. Like that was not a, that wasn't a great experience production wise. I know he, you know, he did a lot of good things that helped him get to the point that he's on, but that was not like Gunnar Henderson in the way you see him now at Aberdeen. So I'm really going to be focused on that portion of Jackson Holliday's season. I'm sure the Orioles would be thrilled if he got the Bowie at the end of the year, but to face the kind of pitching that league, that high A league, presents these pitchers, these hitters with, and to hit in that environment will probably be a really good challenge for Jackson Holliday. I don't think there's any doubt in the Orioles' mind that he can handle that kind of challenge, but it's not a level where there's been a ton of offensive success, and it'll be a good challenge to see him get there. And that's why when you see like people say he's going to be the number one overall prospect in baseball next year, like I'm not saying that's not going to happen, but like for that to happen and for him to follow like the offensive trajectory that some of the guys have recently at Aberdeen would be kind of, it would be a curiosity.
Love it. Yeah, I just like seeing the fact that he's still in big league camp. And I just look to, I don't know how much stock we put into, I don't know if Baseball Reference has that opponent quality rating that you can look up for spring training. And Jackson Holliday is pretty solid, 6.2, which is pushing up there towards a double A competition. So give you a little bit of an idea of who he's facing. But looking ahead at a more established prospect who should be on the opening day roster, you wrote a little bit about Grayson Rodriguez today on your Substack, but you had the opportunity to also watch him in his last outing down there in Sarasota. What did you see that stood out to you, and how do you think he looked compared to some of your looks from last year?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like for the first three innings, like he just looked like Grayson Rodriguez. He was like throwing in the upper 90s. He was locating his fastball. He was getting chase on his off-speed pitches out of the zone. We weren't talking about a lineup of big leaguers, but even given that, it still looked really good. It was reminiscent of like the outcomes and the way that he was kind of in control at the early part of the game, of like the Bowie version of him that everyone kind of came to like a lot. And then in the fourth inning, like honestly in Bowie too, he would have like innings where he would just kind of be overthrowing and then start to place it and like not be able to do it. The difference is this is spring training and he's not built up. So he didn't get to get out of his own jam, but I look at, you know, I've seen those innings from him before. He doesn't strand the bases loaded in those, but he doesn't give up six runs in them either. So like he gets a chance to get out of them. And if he has pitches left, he usually comes out in the fifth and like strikes out two guys and then pitches into the sixth. Like that's just kind of how it's been, when he had those. So it was interesting to see kind of that opportunity not given to him. There's not going to be any public concern, you know, from somebody like Brandon Hyde about anything like that. You know, if a pitcher knows that he was trying to place the ball and not throw it through the strike zone, like that's easily correctable, especially for someone like Grayson Rodriguez. But truthfully, watching those first few innings, I was back in a place that, you know, I was sitting in Prince George's Stadium, you know, sweating on a night in July. And like, that's what it was. It was the same feeling.
Going through that inning that he couldn't get out of, I was listening to Brett Hollander and Scott Garceau on the call yesterday. It sounded like his command got away from him a little bit, and then the balls that were put in play, one of them was hit hard, but the others weren't. Was that kind of what happened?
Yeah. I mean, he was throwing the ball. You know, he wasn't like pounding the strike zone. And he was getting into like disadvantageous counts. But even as he was getting hit, there was one ball that was misplayed. I think there was another one played down the line that like the fielder got to and like missed a transfer. There was another soft hit. I think it wasn't like he was like smacked around. And when I thought like how could the spring like not work out for him, it was like this is somebody who can give up like weak contact in the air. And like on a day like today, if he had pitched today and given up like two pop-ups left field, like they would have gone out. And like that was what I thought would be like, you know, the thing that could like undo him in the spring like this, just pitching in Florida. But that's not really what happened. It was just like, you know, he was not able to, you know, consistently put the ball in the strike zone the way that he wanted to, and that meant he wasn't getting chase on the pitches he would have otherwise. And that's not like a systematic problem for him. That's not characteristic. That's just somebody who in a moment, you know, to hear him tell it and to hear Brandon Hyde tell it again a moment, like did not go back to what he does well, just was trying to do something else. And I don't think there's any larger cause for concern on that, but it wasn't like he was getting smacked around, to answer your question.
Shifting gears, when we had you on back in the fall to talk about the top 10 prospect list, Heston Kjerstad was either in the middle of or kind of at the tail end of that run he had in the Arizona Fall League. He's now followed that up with an impressive spring training. Considering those two things, what are realistic expectations for him now, this year and beyond?
Truthfully, you know, I haven't gotten a chance to speak to him in my brief time down here. But I've, you know, read some of the people who have talked to him, and it seemed like, you know, I seemed like there was a real like light bulb moment in the AFL, no matter the ballparks or the pitching that he was facing, where it was like it was happening for him and it was happening well. And like that's something that, you know, that's really important for hitters as they're developing, as they're growing into themselves. And that's under normal circumstances, and nothing about his development or professional career has been normal. So it seems like there was meaningful progress in like seeing the results, believing the results. I don't think anyone doubted that he was going to hit the ball hard and continues to hit the ball in the air. And I think when we spoke last, that, you know, the idea of him starting in Bowie next year and hitting like having like 15 home runs at the All-Star break was not out of the question whatsoever, just because of the type of power he has. At that level of the minors, it's sometimes harder to get to it, that power, because pitchers know how to attack you and they know how to get you to chase and they know your weak spots. So, you know, we've seen that with other power hitters at that level. It could be a little challenging to make that adjustment, and the level of experience and the actual like professional at-bats could be a hindrance to that. But like, I don't think there's anything to change his outlook, anything about that. You know, it still was a complete realistic possibility that he was going to be the Heston Kjerstad that the Orioles drafted this year. And it would be foolish to read into the performance last year. It's also possible that the inexperience continues to show. I don't know what the spring, you know, I've seen a couple at bats this spring. I don't know what a spring performance really says about what he could do going forward. But on a very basic level, like you just want to see a guy have success if like for the purposes of confidence. And like, that is the idea of a good spring for him, I think. And I think that it's providing that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I was able to see him hit a couple out the opposite field. It was good to see him turn on one today and just crush it off the glass. Was that in Atlanta, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was cool. And let's see. Colton Cowser, a controversial prospect all of a sudden. Despite putting up big numbers across three levels last year, rise in strikeouts and some less than stellar write-ups by some national outlets have made him a topic of debate recently. How has your assessment of Cowser and his potential changed over the last year?
I some of the things that caused him to fall down the other list, you know, the left right splits and that type of stuff and the contact rates, like those are things that people with the Orioles and people who are, you know, our scouts who cover the Orioles, they talk about those things, they see those things. I think there's just different ways to weight them. And, you know, as I sit here and I'm thinking about this right now, you know, if you know, we're talking about someone like Heston Kerstad who shows, you know, X ability and Y deficiency, and like the deficiency is weighted heavily versus like Colton Cowser who can do like X very well and Y not very well, like, but Y is not weighted as heavily. Like, I guess there's some merit to like how you weight those things. But I don't think there's any real, you know, personally, I've internalized, I've talked to people about like why somebody like Cowser wouldn't be on the top 100 list, why somebody would be, you know, concerned about the platoon type splits. But I'm not sure that my own personal outlook has changed about that. It's just a player that hasn't, like, you know, I think lefties traditionally don't see as many lefties as you think they do coming up through the minors. It's something that could probably be worked on with experience. I know the Orioles are pretty aggressive in making sure if you have something that you need to work on like that, that you get the ways to work on it. But it's interesting. I was actually talking to someone about this yesterday, and he was like, yeah, somebody who has those type of splits, like, has no business on a top 100 list, and like, it's somebody I respect. And that is like a valid thing. Like, if we're talking about somebody who might end up being a platoon player, but, you know, even if that's the case, we're talking about like the big part of a platoon. You're talking about like center field capable defense. You're talking about somebody who has the ability to be like an on base, you know, high on base table setter at the top of the lineup, or like own in on his hot zones and like be more of a slugger. Like, there's a lot of offensive capability there. And I think that evaluating prospects and writing about prospects is about, you know, everyone has their own set of criteria for that. Everyone has their own kind of lens to view that through. And those create things that I'm trying to figure out. Those create things that like can be like huge boosters in some cases or huge disqualifiers in some cases. And, you know, as somebody who does it, like, you learn to respect other people's processes and what they value, as long as they're consistent with it. So that's kind of where I learned on that.
And Gunnar struggled against lefties because he hadn't seen too many either. Then he takes Ethan Small deep in his first AAA at bat, or one of his first at least. And yeah, hopefully he can iron that out. But at least he's quieted down the questions of his power. Seems like even that home run he hit today wasn't exactly wind aided.
No, it was much. You know, there was wind, but it landed pretty far. It landed pretty far past the fence.
Right, we're gonna focus on a lot of the pitching here for a little bit. We know a lot of Orioles fans very curious about the depth of pitching prospects in this system. But we had Chase McDermott on last week, and he revealed that he was ditching the changeup in favor of a splitter. Acknowledged that, you know, finding the strike zone, honing in on that is going to be a big thing for him. Based on what you've seen and heard, we've heard a lot about the trade partner, the guy that came over at the same time, and Cade Povich, but McDermott's more of a, haven't heard as much about him from outside sources. What's it going to take for him to kind of stick as a starter in this organization?
I think you probably identified it well. You know, they love that kind of stuff. They love that kind of, you know, pitch mix. They love the versatility. I know recently it's kind of become a little more in vogue to like work on a splitter. It's a hard pitch to throw, but it's an effective pitch to both sides if you can. Whereas sometimes, you know, guys kind of get into boxes and like only throw like their change up against opposite sides. I think they feel really comfortable with a splitter as a weapon to both sides. And you can check a lot of boxes just with one pitch if you have an effective one. But he knows himself better than anyone else. And like, I think I saw him pitch twice, and one time it was like kind of raining. I feel like it was one of his first buoy starts, and like it was raining, and like they probably shouldn't have been playing, but they did, and it was just kind of a toughie. And then you see him when he is able to consistently a second time command the ball in the strike zone. Just the quality of his pitches is really high. I mean, the Orioles aren't going to trade for somebody or acquire somebody that doesn't have those characteristics, but to be able to harness that in the strike zone and make it so that if you have pitches that move a lot, you know, A, they need to look like strikes out of hand. B, you need to prove that you can throw them in the strike zone so hitters know that they're not just going to end up in the dirt. And C, you have to do all those things consistently and like pitch to the plan and stuff like that. Like, it's just, you know, he had a head start a little bit in like being in the Astros pitching program, and they did a lot of things similarly from what I understand. But he also moved pretty quickly last year, and I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for growth there.
On your list, McDermott is in a range that has a lot of interesting arms in it. Justin Armbruster, Noah DeNoyer, Drew Rahm, and Carlos Tavera. And we know that as part of the process of Baseball America follows, risk factor is part of these grades. When you consider that section of the list, who do you see as maybe the safest pitcher in that group? And then on the flip side, who would be the riskiest?
Oh, gosh. Did we count Povich in this mix? Yes or no?
No, Povich is
okay, Povich, yeah. Okay. So, gosh, safest, riskiest. This is challenging. I think based on, and this is not to do with.
I'll insert the Jeopardy music in post.
Yeah, this is fantastic. this is fantastic audio. And I mean, it's all... mileage may vary on whether it's quality video either. I think that Noah DeNoyer has a pretty high floor of being some kind of major league contributor just based on he's on the roster, and you have a good fastball, you have quality pitches otherwise. I think that's pretty safe. I don't want to say Drew Rahm is the most risk, but we just know that it's so challenging to be a left-hander who needs to mix his pitches and locate perfectly and not have an overpowering fastball pitching in this division and pitching for the Orioles. I'm sure the part where they moved the wall back, 20 feet or whatever it was is good for that. But through no fault of his own, it's just a risky profile. And I would also say just by there's risk everywhere, McDermott with the strike throwing, Carlos Tavera with the amount of innings. I don't think that I don't think there's anything necessarily more safe or more risky, but I was thinking about it when I was over at Twin Lakes, who are we talking about? The guys we were talking about in this portion of the list, the pitchers last year, you had Kyle Brnovich, you had we're talking about Peak and Young and Pinto and in this range, there's just so much, volatility from year to year. Injuries can happen. Guys can kind of go sideways stuff wise. You have guys who can do what the guys who were talking about did, jump onto the list. And I think that's one of the things that makes following this system and paying attention to it fascinating, because the way they develop pitching really lends itself to there being a breadth and depth of it. I know I'm just doing a terrible job of answering this question, but I did think about that as I was over at Twin Lakes. All these guys that we were talking about, could these be the guys who make the next step, which is really what we're thinking about with these guys. What are these guys going to look like in AAA? Who's going to push to the big leagues? The reality is it's just pretty much none of the guys that were in this mix last year ended up doing that, having healthy seasons, being able to follow up. It's just really challenging, and that's why you kind of pause when you're thinking about a safe and risk assessment there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And my question is kind of along a similar vein. Is this the season that puts the Orioles pitching development theory, you've discussed it a lot on your mailbag, your Substack, about how they target the guys that they think they can develop. Is this a year that, that kind of gets put to the test a little bit with Elias's own guys, DeNoyer, Watson, Armbruster, Tavera, reaching the upper minors and starting to break into the majors?
I think so, but I think for a different reason, honestly. I mean, the Orioles pitching project is going to be, I would say, 75% defined by how Grayson Rodriguez does in the big leagues. That's going to be, and that's mainly because people who, there are people who follow it closely and kind of know the names we're talking about and understand that when you're drafting where they draft and getting players to, in the avenues that they do, that you're not going to get the Grayson Rodriguez's, and people look at the Grayson Rodriguez's. So for Grayson Rodriguez to prove to be the real deal, what I think just be really beneficial for as an endorsement for this pitching plan versus other ones where the Grayson Rodriguez types, for whatever reason didn't launch. I do think that there is going to be real opportunity for more of those guys to push into that level. The more guys get to the high minors and the more they have success, at some point that becomes real. And at some point, a chance is required. And in a lot of these cases, it's not going to be because there's, smoke and mirrors or because it's like deception. It's because of the stuff and the way that they target stuff and the way they develop stuff and the way that they identify, you know, the pitches and the traits that work and make them better because of the coaches, because of the analysts, all that type of stuff. So yes, I think there is a pretty big opportunity for someone to be like that. Like, Lord knows, a pop-up guy, any kind of guy who, you know, comes from that level and becomes like a top tier pitching prospect does that trick. But I think Grayson Rodriguez, and whether he is, you know, what he's supposed to be, is going to have just as much, if not more, influence on that.
Speaking of pop-up guys, maybe going a little bit deeper here, outside of the top 30 list that you got over at Baseball America, there's also 10 extra Orioles names to know. And maybe this would be drawing more from that list, or maybe some guys that you've got your eye on outside of that list that you maybe wanted to include. Can you give us some John Mioli breakout picks for 2023? Are there like a hitter and a pitcher that you think Orioles fans or more people outside of Birdland even are going to know this name by the end of 2023?
So we're talking outside the top 30 guys?
Yeah,
let's see.
Yeah, let's make it tougher for you.
Yeah. I'm just like feeling really unprepared right now. I'm sorry. I think that, I think on the pitching side, I keep looking at this like a doofus. I've talked about him a little bit. Actually, no, I'm not going to go with that one. This is such bad audio. I'm sorry, guys. I'm ruining your podcast. I'm going to break the rules. I think that people know about Carlos De Vera. I don't think that anyone, you know, he's in the top 30. I don't know how many top 30s he's in or where he is in other rankings. But, like, I think that the pitcher who got hurt last year and ended up, you know, not being able to finish the season for health reasons, cut short, like, what was going to be a really, really impressive year. I mean, he was, like, there were stretches where he was ridiculous in Aberdeen. And we would be having a lot more significant conversations about him. I think that's like a breakout type that you kind of want to keep an eye on. Outside the top 30 for hitters is a little more challenging for me because I feel like there's a lot of hitters who are, you know, properly rated there. I'm going to go with, again, I'm going to cheat and I'm going to say number 30, Anderson De Los Santos. I saw him, you know, he hit a bomb in one of the minor league sim games recently. He just looks like really athletic and like really like one of those, like, he just looks the part and like seeing him for one minor league sim game. And I know they're really excited about him. So I didn't answer the question well, and I didn't actually answer the question at all, but I'm going to go with those two. But it's interesting, you know, like you talk about like what a sleeper is. And like so many guys like qualify but don't qualify. That like, I don't know, I'm just rambling. I'm sorry.
No, I like those picks. I'm hoping Carlos De Vera is a dude in this system. I know Matt Blood's pushed his name out for 2 years now. And it's also good to hear that it sounds like he's gonna be ready to go when the regular season starts. I know you mentioned there was, you know, the issue that ended his season shortly, but he's good to go.
Yeah, I saw him throwing a bullpen when I was over there on Thursday, and you know, it's from the side, it's from like, you know, 50 feet away, but you kind of, you know, he was doing what everyone else was doing, and I think that's a good sign this time of year.
Yeah, I think people are sleeping on Anderson De Los Santos a little bit, so I like that pick. He's not a top 30 on everyone's list. And I thought you were going to say Trace Bright for a pitcher, and that would have helped my locked-on draft because I have him as my number four starter over there. But
I, you know, true life, I have, like, my notes document over here, which is, like, 40-something pages long. And, like, every single person I talked to, I asked for their sleeper, and he came up, like, four times. So, like, literally, if I'm looking for sleeper, I have a heading here that I'm staring at right now. Like, it's just his sleeper. And, you know, on his, it says, just his ridiculous track, man, which, you know, is what you want.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, there you go.
Sticking with pitching, and then we'll kind of pivot to other areas of the organization. With D.L. Hall missing time this spring, you wrote recently about that scenario, and I think you correctly pointed out there really is not an ideal situation right now, at least in the short term, because he's either going to have to go back to AAA or he's going to have to work out of the bullpen, at least at the start of the year. So with that in mind, what do you think the Orioles ultimately are going to do with him? And that, I guess I acknowledge that we have not seen him throw this spring, so that makes it a little tough to guess.
Yeah, I want to say Brandon Hyde said yesterday that games are like one step away, like there might be a sim game and then games. I would say that, you know, if sitting here right now, if you had to make me say what they're going to do, I think that they'll err on like keeping him a starter. It doesn't seem like the bullpen is going to be really anywhere near full strength. It'll be a lot stronger if Felix Patiss is able to pitch on opening day or very close to it. But, there's going to be a lot of temptation, I think, to have him, you know, in that stuff in the bullpen. But I have not gotten any indication that they're ready to give up on him as a starter. I don't think there's any reason to. That's my personal opinion. But I think they also realize that, you know, what you're dealing with when it is working is really, really impactful. And, you know, really we're talking about somebody who, even though you consider him healthy last year, it was a slow buildup and there was, you know, they needed to manage his innings. Like, that was really his first full healthy season in a long time. So you build on that, you know, just because you got through that checkpoint doesn't mean you go in a different direction. You build on that. It might ultimately be better. Because if he was out here in spring training games, like throwing 99 with like three at least plus pitches and like carving up lineups, and then you have to put him in the rotation and like, who knows what's going to happen. So maybe a little more time with Justin Ramsey down in Norfolk and really like solidifying what he worked on last year and being the best version of himself. And most importantly, applying what he learned in the big leagues. Like, it wasn't a smooth ride for him, but he, I think, pretty well internalized like what he needs to do to succeed. And also in moments had reinforced what he does well and how he should, you know, continue to do those things. So if you take somebody who has that experience, even though it's not an ideal situation, and he makes five starts in Norfolk and they're a lot better, then you're going to feel really good about the fact that you didn't stash him in the bullpen and have him pitch like the fifth inning in Texas next month. You know,
I'm looking at the system as a whole for a minute. We're used to seeing international signing. We're still new to the international signings for the Orioles, relatively new. And the player development paths they take. Considering that, when is it okay to write off a prospect? Because we've seen Michael Hernandez now struggle 2 years in a row, concerns about whether or not he's going to hit at the plate. And then on the flip side of that, you see a guy like Frederick Bencosme break out the way that he did last year. And you look at the hype coming into this season for Samuel Basayo. When do you think it's okay to buy the hype and be completely bought in on a player?
To take the first one first, you know, there's going to be a point at some, like with a lot of the recent international signings where like, there's just not time to be patient anymore, but we're talking about a class of two classes, really. I mean, even if you want to talk about the most recent class, like there's been a lot of development time impacted. That's not to say a lot of development time hasn't gone into like getting these players into the system and accustomed to the system. But it's just, I would say that like you need to give like a lot of rope in these. I think there's also like not only guys that don't perform in the FCL, but like even guys that struggle going to Delmarva. Like most of them wouldn't have been in Delmarva last year, for example. I know Hernandez doesn't fit into that category, but you're going to see a lot of Delmarva repeaters this year just because they didn't have Aberdeen to do that. It's almost like if you portion up the season last year, like you basically had like Delmarva season was like three Aberdeen seasons, like playing a level up and like sometimes not having the best time at it. So I think that this is probably going to be a year just from a numbers perspective, like where some of those players who haven't really taken off yet need to, in order to justify their spot in Delmarva the following year, like really show that they've got it. But I think on the flip side, when we're talking about guys, like when do you buy the hype? I think there's a lot of factors that go into that. It's not just like stats based. Somebody like Basayo, you know, anecdotally, I was told like even though he had 6 home runs last year, there were like 5 to the warning track, and like maybe that means something, maybe it doesn't. Like, but if he has 11 home runs in the FCL, like, how different is the conversation that we're having? You know, I talk to people who are like, yeah, you know, he hit a little bit, but like there were like the game I saw, he like didn't catch like 6 balls, and it's like, oh, you need to do that. We're talking about players who have a lot of development ahead of them. Even some like Ben Cosme, the same thing, like he gets a lot, makes a lot of contact. Some of it's strong contact, some of it's not that strong. And I know the Orioles really emphasize making that like hard contact. It's a pretty tough transition to be like one of those hitterish, like puts the bat on everything guys, and really hone in on those zones the Orioles want you to swing into. So like, that's a long answer to like a simple question. I think you look at where they are age appropriate wise, you look at production, you look at what's leading to that production, and whether it's like sustainable contact, sustainable, you know, strikeout walk type stuff. And it's kind of like a holistic picture. But I think like the reason to ask is like, because there's going to be opportunities probably this year to say, oh, like there are legitimate international prospects that have come out of this system. And I think that when you see it, you know, for a year, for 2 years on the full season level, then it's hard not to acknowledge that that's real.
So we talked about how the bullpen, you know, there's a couple injuries. Maybe Felix Bautista doesn't start the year with the club. Maybe he comes in a week later or less. Or anyway, there's seems to be some openings for guys like a Michael Bauman, a Rule 5 pick Andrew Politi, to maybe grab one of those last spot or two in the bullpen. How do you see that shaking out?
I'm pretty fascinated to see what happens with Bauman. I think that what they did last year was pretty smart in like letting him start and like continue on that development. You also get the benefit kind of the same as DL Hall. Like, hey, you got a taste of this, but like, why don't you just go and be a starter for X long and say, like, I'm applying what I learned. I'm doing what I'm good at. I'm tweaking things. I'm gripping this pitch differently, X, Y, Z, and do that stuff where you can, so that you get the benefit of that major league time. I think that, you know, I feel like it was last weekend, not this past weekend, the weekend before, that Mike Elias was on the radio basically saying, like, there's not that many, like, bullpen spots up for grabs. It was during one of the broadcasts. He said that there's a lot fewer of those than you usually have. I haven't, you know, spent any meaningful time watching Andrew Politi hand up. Sorry about that. I don't even know if he's pitching the game I've been at. But I think that there is – you know, a lot of value to try to keep that kind of arm if you can. But I think there's going to be a need for long relief types. And you know, this organization is about a lot of things, but they're very pretty dogmatic about like keeping as many players who they like as possible. So like that usually means guys with options get optioned, guys who don't have options or they can't option, like stick around, and then you kind of figure it out as you go along. So depending on if the stuff in like the player or what they think it is with Politi, like I wouldn't be surprised if they gave it a shot. If you're talking about somebody like one of those guys with options versus like an Austin Voth as a reliever, like you might err on the side of the guy who's like going to be on the roster and like they can't get rid of because they just want to keep him around. So that's kind of how they've operated in the past, and that's how I'm expecting they operate this spring.
We'll see. There's been a lot of chat, especially in the Patreon group, I know about Michael Bauman. And I think we talked about him last week. I didn't realize he's already like 27 years old. Like he's been around for a long
yeah.
time. But looking at this organization, zooming out a little bit more, 2022 was a pretty healthy year at the major league level, at least, other than John Means' Tommy John surgery. But this spring, other than the little bullpen bumps at the very beginning, like day one of camp, we haven't really heard too much about unfortunate injuries either. Are the Orioles doing anything different from a strength and conditioning standpoint, or has it just been kind of luck that we shouldn't be expected to continue? I guess it's kind of relevant now I'm thinking about the Ravens discussion and all their strength and conditioning hazards.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're getting an F-. I think, you know, and this is not having any inside knowledge of what happens like in the training room or in the weight room or anything, but I think that I think they have pretty targeted programs for like what somebody needs to do movement wise, like get them moving the right way, whether it's swing or whether it's delivery type stuff. I would imagine just based on the number of like hamstrings that blew out last year that they're like really, really being aggressive and making sure that doesn't happen again. But honestly, we're talking, you know, I know Ryan O'Hearn like did something to his knee recently. Like poor Joey Ortiz got like a chopper to the head while taking ground balls or something. But like if that's like, that's like, that's not like a, I'm not downplaying brain injury, so I'm just going to stop talking. But like those aren't the types of things that we're talking about in terms of like in the training room. So I do think they've, I don't know if they're doing anything different necessarily. I think it's kind of like everything else in this organization where they like put a lot of time and energy and resources into doing things, you know, as well as they can be done, and doing them in a relatively progressive manner. But it does, you're right, it does seem like, you know, that Gunnar Henderson wrist injury was a little bit, was, you know, kind of a red flag early in camp. I feel like, you know, it's just like a Michael Elias like injury bomb on the first day. And it's like, okay, all these guys are hurt. Great. But like, it really hasn't been that bad since. So, you know, that's a good camp. That's a good camp from their perspective, I'm sure.
So we're all excited about seeing prospects fill out the spring roster. And it seems like they're pretty much all making good presence with the opportunity that they've been provided so far. I know you've only been down there a few days, but what has the vibe been like around the team, given that most of these guys could make their major league debuts this year or sometime soon after?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like one of the, you know, in the past, and even recent past, like to be a young player in like a big league clubhouse could be challenging because there's just not that many of you. Like these guys who spent like last year or like, you know, were hanging out in Altside a couple years ago or in Bowie the year before, or like spent a lot of time in Bowie or in Norfolk last year. Like they're not like a little clique. Like they kind of are the clique. Like they're the older guys who've been around a little longer and he's like, you know, have families and like, or, you know, and then there's just like, I feel like they're like setting the tone. And this is just like a couple of days in the clubhouse. I'm not in there a lot, but I feel like the young players are, from what I've seen, like very comfortable being themselves. They're acting the same way in the big league spring training clubhouse as they would in between BP groups and Bowie and Aberdeen. And like, it's just interesting to see that, you know, doesn't seem like anybody's really put a foot wrong or like done stuff that they shouldn't have done. It also truthfully doesn't feel like a place where like, you know, there's no Brian McCann, like making sure nobody steps on the carpet logo in the clubhouse and like yelling at people for not following unwritten rules. Like, I think it's a pretty chill environment. So like, that's good. But, you know, it's been pretty interesting to see like how smooth of a transition it is. I've heard, you know, from some of these guys and people around them, like how welcoming the older guys have been and how they've been helpful. And like, it's really all you can ask for.
Honestly, it seems like the team kind of had that in mind when they made some of these acquisitions this offseason. I know it wasn't exactly, you know, the offseason fans wanted, but you get guys like James McCann, Kyle Gibson, Adam Frazier, who are seem like they're pretty well known for being good clubhouse chemistry guys. So maybe that's working out. Maybe that's the, what was it, the MVP machine or Astro Ball. That was like why they brought in Carlos Beltran, like that aspect that you can't exactly quantify exactly. But
yeah.
Changing subjects completely. Does it mean anything that Hudson Haskin wasn't invited to big league spring training as a top 30 prospect while these other guys did? Or is it more about, hey, we'll give Robert Nystrom one last chance to prove himself and it just was a numbers game?
Yeah, I lean towards numbers game. Honestly, I went over there. He was one of the guys I talked to when I was at Twin Lakes. It'll be landing in, you know, everyone's email in the morning. It was convenient, but slightly inconvenient that he hit the home run because then everybody got talked to him too. But it kind of seemed like a numbers deal to me. I know that, you know, especially the types of players, like when you look at where his playing time would be, like there's not going to be a lot of playing time in center field with Mullins and Hayes and McKenna and then Colton Kazer being like, you know, the designated six inning seven center fielder in a lot of these games, like not going to get a lot of time in center. And given how, you know, the corner spots are A, accounted for on, you know, when the starter level would be like occupied by all these like I don't even want to call them backup first baseman competition people because there's not really a backup first baseman competition. But all those types, you know, those non-roster like slugger types, like there's just really didn't seem like there were a ton of places for him to play and get those opportunities. And you know, I can't imagine he was thrilled with it. But he is spending, you know, he mentioned today that like he's gotten a lot of at bats, he's gotten a lot of work in at Twin Lakes and going to early camp and getting stuff through the early, you know, full minor league spring training. So while it's a good experience and while, you know, I'm sure in his heart, he would probably trade, you know, 200 mixed BP sessions at Twin Lakes for 10 like big league spring training at bats. Like there's a world where this worked out probably in his favor. But he also, you know, showed up today and he had a home run. So if they, it's easy to say like, hey, maybe you should have brought me on. I'm sure he had a little bit of that thought as he's around the bases and who wouldn't?
Something here is a quick question about Haskin because he feels like he's one of those prospects that does a little bit of everything right. Yet yeah. It feels like maybe it's because of the depth in the system or the unorthodox swing label that he got tagged with in college that he hasn't gotten the widespread recognition that you might expect. What do you think he has to do to sort of put himself at the next level of that conversation when we're talking about him as a guy that could contribute to the major league roster in some way, shape, or form for a long time?
Yeah. You know, I think there's just like, I think it's kind of what we were just talking about, like where does he go? And it's not like it's not an issue in Bowie. Like he was a fantastically productive player last year by all the surface stats. He played center field well when he was called upon. He played his positions well, like wherever outfield spot they put him in well. But you're getting into like the business end of, you know, his development and what path are you going to take? He'll probably play some center field in Norfolk, but he's not going to play a lot because Colton Cowles is going to play a lot of center field. And like, that's just the reality of that situation. And then you need to, you know, kind of look at whether his bat can support a corner outfield spot. And, you know, there are some indications that it can. And I know he told me, and, you know, I'm just spoiling, you know, I'm just giving away the goods, but like he told me he put on a lot of weight and he was working on like, you know, being more durable throughout the season and, you know, doing some things with a swing to make it a little more forceful and use his lower half a little bit better and iron out some of those inefficiencies. All those things you want to hear because, you know, it's a person that has been able to hit even before that. So if you add the strength, if you add the swing efficiency, something the Orioles are really, really big on getting guys to do, like then you get to the spot where somebody continues to grow into his, you know, grow into his body and physically develop a little bit more, then maybe there is that possibility that he can support a corner spot. But to play center field in this organization right now is probably going to be a challenging hill for him to climb, given what they have and like what's coming up behind him already. So I think that's part of that. It, to me, that's probably part of why, you know, I can't speak for, you know, people who on the outside who are, you know, evaluating him in one way or another, or who are, you know, not inviting him to spring training. That's just kind of my take on it. But I think everything I heard from him, you know, speaking to him a couple of days ago was pretty, it felt like he was addressing some of those things and, you know, and he doesn't really think that there's any reason why, no matter who's here, he can't play center field. And that's what you're supposed to think if you're a baseball player. So all good things.
Just keep eating the Olive Garden cheesecake. That was the night before he hit those three home runs and went to Olive Garden cheesecake, which is weird in itself. But no, hold on. You answered this question kind of in your last answer, but a lot has been made of this backup first base battle. Is that a thing that is real? And whether or not it is, what do you think the odds are that any of the guys, that Lewin Diaz or Yuznail, if you're in Philadelphia, I guess, Ryan O'Hearn, Josh Lester, French Cordero, any of those guys make this roster bar an injury?
It seems like it's slim chances. And I'm like, I don't think any of them are on the 40, right? So like, yeah, they could theoretically have some space, but like, that's not really, you know, I don't think so. I think, you know, before I I've always been kind of a, you know, you don't need a backup first baseman, especially if Santander can stand there. You know, Adley's played first base in the minors. James McCann is planning on it. You know, you can piece together backup first base if you really need it, especially if those bench spots are going to, you know, Kyle Stowers, Darren Bavra, a McKenna type. You know, you have your bases pretty well covered there. It's not like they don't have versatile pieces elsewhere on the bench to not carry you. Like a backup first baseman, where we're not talking about like a Pedro Alvarez who's like, write him in for 30 home runs. We're talking about guys who are like reclamation projects. And that's kind of what I think this is really all about, you know, because of how we talk about spring training and how spring training is covered and discussed. Like, it becomes like a backup first base competition, but it's just like, seems to me like it was like an unintentional accumulation of like reclamation project, like slugger types who hit the ball hard and hit the ball in good, you know, hit the ball well, that's a dumb way of putting it, but like they hit the ball hard and they make good contact, and for whatever reason there's something that's keeping them from doing that consistently at the big league level. And the Orioles have the means, you know, through their coaches, through their strength staff, through their development, overall development program, to like improve those type of guys. And like, there are a lot of bites at the apple there. Like, I think the thinking is that like getting them in this system, getting them doing the drills they do, getting them working on the things the Orioles hitting coaches are trying to get guys to work on is going to help someone become a consistent big league hitter. And the types of players they're talking about, there's like significant power potential there. So like the short answer, like the long answer again, but there is a lot of like power potential, and there's a lot of effort going into unlocking that, because there's a lot of value to like a cheap slugger. And that's really what they want more than a backup first baseman. I think they're trying to find some cheap pop. You don't want to say their own Justin Turner, but like you can say their own Luke Voit and like not be wrong if that's the type of thing they're trying to do.
It's a good perspective on it. And I'll go to this question, and then I think we'll get into some listener questions after this, but do you see the organization as it sits right now, at least in terms of the players who could make the major league roster, standing pat, or would you not be surprised to see a last-minute trade kind of like we saw last year where Tanner Scott and Cole Saucer were dealt to the Marlins?
I think you probably stand pat. I thought it was going a different direction, talking about like what they're going to do down the road. I think it's probably more of a stand pat situation than last year was. I think that like I'm in my mind leaving open like some kind of like roster surprise, like somebody who's expected to be there not being there. But I don't think it's that type of trade. I think that was a pretty unique situation where like they thought and proved to be right. I mean, I don't even know if I want to give them credit for it. Like, they had no idea what the bullpen was going to look like. They had like literally all waiver claims in there, and like all of them just like coalesced into this really good bullpen. But I think they thought that for the value and for the prices and for the players that like they could make that trade last year and like and not be materially different. And I think it proved to be relatively right. I don't see any areas like that other than the areas that they already would have made trades for and we would have already talked about ad nauseum. You know, we've seen infielders get injured in spring training and clubs kind of needs arise, and like there's all the Orioles infielders are still here. So you just kind of assume that that's what's going to happen. I think that really the only spot that they would do that. Maybe they could find a taker for a start, like one of their like 4A starters, but who's really giving those away if they don't have to, and the Orioles don't really have to. So I don't know if there's any trades like that, but you know, I remember being surprised and a little bemused when they traded Tanner Scott and Cole Saucer last year. So, you know, take this for what it's worth.
Got some questions from our patrons, and I'll let Bob start off this section of the show because we've got an interesting mix, some prospect-related stuff and some focused more on the major league roster.
Yeah, you kind of actually just touched on this a little bit, but Ben Doris wants to know, how do you see the AAA/MLB influx of infielders ultimately shaking out, both short-term and long-term?
Gosh, Do I just say slowly? I think it's going to play out slowly, honestly. There's a universe where, like, based on what he did last year and, like, his talent, that, like, Jordan Westberg could be, like, starting the year in the big leagues. It doesn't seem like that avenue's there for him. So it's just a wait-your-turn situation. You know, we know that they want guys to get a lot of AAA experience. So, like, that pushes the clock back for, like, Joey Ortiz and Connor Norby. Like, I just think this is going to play out pretty slowly, to be perfectly honest. I don't know. And I think that's partially to let whatever is going to happen happen. There's not a, you know, I think outside of, like, you know, Jackson Holliday, who doesn't really count in this conversation, like Gunnar Henderson, who's already in the big leagues and, like, is the number one prospect in all of baseball. Like, there's not, like, any kind of clear consensus internally or externally about, like, who of these guys is going to be, like, the best, or who's going to make it or who's going to not make it. So I think they're just going to, like, it's gonna be really, like, unpleasant, but I think they're just going to take their sweet time and, like, let it figure it out. And, like, if all of them have 900 OPSs in Norfolk in July, like, that's great. And if one of them does, then that person wins. And, like, I think they're literally just going to let it play out. Long-term, I think that my preference, and potentially their preference, is going to be guys who hit left-handed and play shortstop and can play shortstop, because that means you can play every other position, and can defend well. So I think I'm interested to see how, especially in the first half of the year, I think it's pretty different from one half of the year and the other. Norfolk in the first half is, like, a very tough place to hit, and then it kind of opens up in the second half as it gets warmer. So I think the true talent is going to rise, but it just might take a while. I know it's not a good answer. I'm not giving, like, everyone, like, 2025 starting Orioles infield. There's too many players, honestly. There's too many players. And I think that makes it's, like, crippling, like, on the outside and probably on the inside too, because when you have that many choices to make, like, it's pretty easy to make the wrong one. So there's just no reason to make a choice now.
It's like picking what you want to watch on Netflix tonight.
Yeah, I'm really bad at that. If you can believe it, I'm really bad at that too.
I mean, at least that's a good problem to have that we're talking about here. Is Connor Norby going to make the major leagues ahead of Joey Ortiz and Jackson Holliday and all these other guys? But yeah. Towns wants to know, in a best case scenario, I think we've kind of touched on some of these guys, but how quickly could some of the top 2022 draftees and Heston Kerstad make it to the big leagues?
I think you're looking at, like, other than, like, an exceptional case, like a Gunnar Henderson case, like, him and Adley are basically the only two guys who have made it to the big leagues, like, in under 2 years of full season ball. In 2020 obviously impacted that a lot. But it's pretty clear how long they want people to be at certain stops given experience levels, and how they value, you know, the amount of plate appearances and success they have at those places. Like, Aberdeen seems like it's in the 200, 250 range. And, like, Dylan Beavers could get to that in May. Jeff Abing can get that in May. And then you spend the rest of the year in Bowie, and then they like to spend a lot of time in Norfolk. It's just kind of how it works out. So, 2022 draftees, you're talking about, like, the end of 2024 maybe. Heston Kerstad maybe a little faster, because, you know, if he becomes the player, you know, he becomes a player that, you know, they wanted him to be, they need to add him to the roster. And you probably add him to the roster anyways, if we're being completely honest. So then you have to talk about, then the conversation changes, because he's an option. So I think he might be a little different case, but by and large, I think all those guys are going to start in Aberdeen again this year. I think they're going to, benefit from having been there last year, and it'll be pretty interesting to see how well they go and how quickly they move.
So Vivek here actually has a question more about your writing. You've been doing the newsletter now for a little more than a year. He wants to know how you have liked going solo and writing and diving deep into the Orioles system, and how does that compare to your time writing about the Red Sox?
Wow, that's a good question. So I've really enjoyed what I've been doing for the last year plus. I enjoyed it when it was, like, part of the bigger picture of, like, covering the big league team. but like I don't miss a lot of like the day-to-day grind. I don't miss any of the day-to-day grind. I respect everyone that does it a lot more just by virtue of them still doing it, but like thank God I don't have to anymore. It makes me so happy every time something happens and I'm like, oh, thank gosh, it's not me. I have not considered, but like when I started working at the Red Sox minor league site, I did Sox Prospects. It was in like 2010 of the like spring of 2010. And they had spent a ton of money in drafts. And they had real, real legit prospects. You know, that was like, you know, Bogarts was just coming onto the scene. Mookie Betts was becoming a dude, like Jackie Bradley. Gosh, who else was in that mix? Blake Swihart didn't really pan out, but he was a first round. That was the year they had four first rounders and like they did a pretty decent job in that draft. Matt Barnes was in there too on the pitching side. I see a little more that organization, like those Red Sox, and like it's obviously a big distinction given what the way we talk about the Orioles now, but like their solution to like their advantage in player development and like player like scouting and player development was money at that point. That was before the slotting rules. So like there, I remember being in a game and sitting next to somebody in their player development department in Frederick when Salem was in there. Must have been like 2011 or 2012. And he turned over to me and we're like, we have $10 million like on the infield right now. Like the four positions and like catcher and pitcher were like $10 million. And like, you know, the Orioles got to that when Grayson and Adley were there. So like, it's redundant. But like back then, like without picking first, like you just spend a lot of money on like every round. Like they would throw $1 million at a bunch of guys. And like, they got some good players out of it. So, what being a little more like dug in and around more with the Orioles system versus like living in Baltimore and seeing like Portland when they came to Bowie or Salem when they came to Frederick, like being in it a little closer and seeing it at a little more like granular level, like there's a lot more, there's like a very cohesive development plan, like with the Orioles that you wouldn't see as much, or guys weren't like talking to me as much about. But it's really like, it's not like just like lip service. Like they really believe in all the things that they talk about and like that they work on and they say they're going to work on. People like talk, like coaches talk to me about like coaching hockey and like they talk to me like about me coaching like club hockey, like about the same, like you're like, oh, they have to do like challenging practice. And I'm like, I know you're saying that, but like, that's like, you're not selling me right now. Like it's like, but like, this is what they legitimately believe in. Like they've, and it like has been borne out in the success. And I think that's been the most interesting thing. As I'm thinking about this, you know, they are doing this with high draft picks here. Let's not kid ourselves, but like, they also are doing it with like guys they take later in the drafts and guys who aren't, you know, who aren't ranked 35th when they're taken 35th. You know what I mean? Like they're doing it with guys they're identifying and they're doing it like as part of a larger plan. And I don't know that the plan was ever that. The Red Sox had great scouts and great player development people, but like, I don't think there was as cohesive of a plan as you see now with the Orioles. That's a good question. I should think about it more.
Vivek, he tends to come up with good questions. Matt Winter would like to know, which prospect do you think we'll get the first call up of the season?
First call up of the season? I'm going to go with Jordan Westby.
Major league debut, I guess. You know, yeah. Not like a DL Hall or something like that.
Yeah. Does Grayson count?
No.
that would be so unfortunate if it does. I'm going to go with Jordan Westby. I just think there are, you know, there are not a lot of needs. You know, if a need arises in April, like there's no need that he can't fill on the infield. Except for backup first base, but you know, he would be, I think he's making a great impression in camp. I think he, you know, if there was a place for him would be like in the mix right now, but like just pretty clear there's not at the moment. So I think he would be the first one. I'm trying to think of if there's like a pitcher, who's like kind of like flying under the radar, but nothing seems to stand out. In that way, a lot of the guys who haven't debuted yet or won't be on the opening day roster are already back on the minor league side. So I think it seems like a Jordan Westberg answer there. That's something I could say a lot more definitively than I said anything else so far.
I think this is the last listener question here. David Adams wants to know, outside of Gunnar, Grayson, and Jackson Holliday, if you could put the John Mioli no trade clause on three prospects, which three are you choosing?
All right. So outside of the top three, John Mioli no trade clause. All right. I'm putting the no trade clause on Dylan Beavers. And that's not first. I'm not saying that because like he's above whoever I'm gonna say next. I don't know who I'm gonna say next, but I just saw him on the list I'm looking at first, and like I just feel pretty strongly that like that's a match of player and player development, and Dylan Beavers answer number one. Just for people who do what I used to do and like kind of still do now, I'm going to put D.L. Hall on that list because the idea of him going to like another team and like getting to be a starter and being good, and like, it's just, nobody needs that. Nobody needs that. It's not like a me thing. That's just like a everybody thing. Like if D.L. Hall is going to be a good starter, for sake of everyone's sanity and like mentions and just like health, well-being, like it should be with the Orioles, just so like there's no DL jokes, there's no like, you know, there's no Orioles, another Orioles pitcher going somewhere else, like we'll just knock all that stuff out. So Beavers, we'll go DL Hall, and we'll go with, why don't we go like a little deeper and say like, I guess it's not very deep. Oh, this is so tough. I'm so bad at answering these questions, guys. This is like the first time I've gone on that I haven't asked you how many times I've been on, and like I know it's gonna be never again. So I know that's the quality performance I'm giving. I'll say Basayo.
Spring training.
I'll say Basayo. You just keep that. It's also really valuable, so I understand completely why they would, and like I wouldn't begrudge them for doing it. If it's for a big piece, But again, that's just like a really valuable thing. And I know that they kind of view like things that are very valuable as like, if they're this valuable now, they could be more valuable in a year. So maybe I'll adopt that thinking for this. I started out answering that one really well.
No, I like the D.L. Hall point is actually a fascinating point that I had never even thought about. What if D.L. Hall does end up somewhere else? You're talking about the question earlier about Grayson Rodriguez and his success at the major league level this year, kind of being the big thing that says, all right, can the Orioles pitching development work at the next level? Grayson being that first example there. If D.L. Hall leaves and is successful elsewhere, I don't know how the Orioles rebound from that when you're talking about developing pitchers.
It would just be so annoying. It would just be so like, and you know, everything else, like Dylan Bundy going to be like the Angels pitcher of the year, like after he got traded, like whatever. Like I wasn't here for like Jake Arrieta or any other stuff, but like, you know, Kevin Gausman, like becoming Kevin Gausman finally, like I understand. I know the history of it. This would be one that just felt like very unfortunate if it played out this way.
Yeah. I think that for everybody's well being, I agree with you, John. We can't, you know, have that happen, and we can't have another civil war over someone at second base in Norfolk again. let's not have a repeat of 2021.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and like you guys probably get to experience it a little more than me. I've tried to just like not dive into all that stuff, but it's pretty fascinating, like the passion for and against some things, and like, you know, the track record of things that like people who are on the team now have nothing to do with being assigned to that. So I just did that with D.L. Hall, but like it's just the less conflict, the better.
Completely agree. And John, thank you so much for coming on tonight. This was your seventh appearance. I think the next episode you'll break the record, and we are going to have you back on. Now, you've got a couple of things to plug. You've got the newsletter, and you've got the Prospect Handbook. So Prospect Handbook is out now, correct?
Correct. Yeah, it's out. I believe it was a print edition and e-edition. I came down to Florida for the newsletter to I didn't really do as much as I wanted to in the off season in terms of reporting. I mean, there's nothing like getting into a clubhouse, getting onto the field with talking to people and digging into stories. And I was jonesing for that a little bit. These last few days have been awesome. I feel like you know, unfortunately, I did it a little late in the spring. There's only like going to be like 2+ weeks left by the time I get home to write all these things and get ready for the season. But like, it's really been fascinating to learn some of the things I did and talk to some of the people I have. I think there's going to be some really cool stories coming out of this, and I encourage people to keep following along.
Yeah, check that out over at Substack, Maximizing Playoff Odds, the Baltimore Orioles newsletter. John, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
All right, thanks for having me, guys. Thanks for bearing with me.
Always.
That does it for our show. We will be back next week. Andy Koska, the Baltimore Banner, will be joining us. So we're looking forward to hearing from Andy, his insight, everything going on with the Orioles. In between shows, check out our Twitter at BSL on the Verge. And head over to BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com, where you can catch all the latest covers on college basketball, the Orioles, football, and more. And while you're there, hop on the message board and join in discussion with fellow readers of the site as well as contributors to BSL. And we had an appearance with our friend Connor Newcomb over at Locked On Orioles last week with our minor league draft. That is now posted in two. Be sure to check that out. We will be back next week. For Bob Phelan and Nick Stevens, this is Zach Spedden. You've been listening to On the Verge.
That'll do it for this week's episode of On the Verge. Be sure to check out our Patreon page where you can help show your support for the show and get bonus content, including monthly top 50 updates to our prospect list and daily game recaps during the season and much, much more.